I can't emphasize enough that after 20 years of fighting the global war on terror with a population of veterans, with multiple deployments, with excessive trauma exposure, the time you spend just sort of bearing witness to what they've been through and embodying compassionate care, you really make all the difference in the world.
This is Meaningful Medicine. In a challenging and unpredictable world with high burnout rates, this is a podcast where incredible individuals share their most meaningful patient experiences and focus on those moments of positivity and joy that sparked their love of healthcare and changed the way they practice medicine.
Hi, I'm Nicole Hohenstein, and I'm an emergency medicine resident at UCSF.
Hi, I'm Shiva Kayambashi. I'm a doctor and professor of family and community medicine at UCSF.
We're the co-hosts of Meaningful Medicine. We created this podcast to highlight stories of healthcare professionals who have found a sense of meaning, resilience, and joy in their work. Hi, Shiva. How are you doing?
Hi, Nicole. I'm doing pretty well today. Thank you. How are you today?
I am doing great. I'm very excited to discuss the topic of working with veterans in medicine today.
I am too. Nicole, the times that we're living in are really full of war. Unfortunately, the world is full of many wars. The United States is involved in wars. Previously, some 20 or 30 years ago, when I was a resident and a medical student, our veterans were mostly veterans that I knew from my experience from the Korean or Vietnam wars, and they were older veterans. But in the last 20 years, we have had so many, I think tragically and very sadly, there have been so many wars, and many of our military have been deployed overseas and between the Persian Gulf and Iraq and Afghanistan and more. We have many veterans of these wars, and they're much younger. And we're seeing people with all kinds of injuries, both physical and mental and emotional and spiritual. We have a lot of patients that we see with traumatic brain injuries, with PTSD, with depression, anxiety, substance use disorders that come from those, and often self-medicating, and resultant, you know, social issues like homelessness and loss of social support. And it's really very sad to see. And I'm really grateful that we have a chance to speak with our guest today, who is a veteran himself and who we will introduce in a moment. So I'm excited and grateful that we have this chance to talk today.
I am so excited to introduce Dr. Mikel Motto, a psychiatrist at UCSF who works with veteran patients at the San Francisco Veterans Affairs Medical Center. He received his medical degree from UC Davis and completed his residency and forensic psychiatry fellowship at UCSF. Dr. Amato is an expert in implementing violence risk assessment tools to promote patient safety and uncouple the stigmatizing relationship between mental health and violence. We will also discuss his personal experience as a veteran and how it has shaped his journey and practice in medicine. Welcome, Dr. Amato.
Thank you, Nicole, and thank you, Shiva, both. I appreciate the chance to be here.
We like to start out each episode by asking our guest to, in short, share a meaningful moment from early on in your training that was a particularly formative or defining experience.
I think for me, it was while I was in medical school at UC Davis. I participated in the student-run clinic program. I was one of the student co-directors at the Joan Viteri Memorial Clinic, which is a clinic that provided healthcare for uninsured drug users and sex workers. It was founded by Neil Flynn, who's a wonderful, wonderful UC Davis internist. I think the reason it was so meaningful to me is that I came to medical school quite late in life, and I gave up a career and moved from friends and a city I love to become a student again. And I felt like I was saying goodbye to a lot of precious things that came with making such a drastic career change. But then working at the Joan Viteri Clinic and working with the co-directors, working with the volunteer faculty, and especially working with the patient population, and those are communities that are so marginalized and underserved. There was so much blood, sweat, and tears into keeping this little student-run clinic up and operating that seeing all the passion from the medical students and all the volunteers, I think it was the first time I felt like I kind of met my tribe. You know, it wasn't sexy and it wasn't easy and it certainly didn't pay anything, but I think it was probably the first time since biting the bullet and going to medical school that I felt confident that I'd made the right decision.
I am super interested in understanding how you fit medical school into your life, especially because you served our country as well. And thank you again for your service.
My military service, I consider it sort of veteran light. I served in the Reserve Corps in the Army for about 12 or 13 years, and only I think about three of it was active duty service in total. I didn't join until I was in medical school. I came from a military family, but I wasn't really comfortable with the idea of joining the military until I had a role that I felt that I could sort of play and feel good about playing. So it wasn't until I came to medical school that I actually pursued that, but it fit in nicely with medicine in that way.
Can you discuss, now that you've been working as a psychiatrist, how your experience as a veteran has impacted the way you care for your patients? And if you have any examples of patient experiences that you'd like to share as well, that would be wonderful.
The best way I can describe it is I'm very much a proponent of seeing veterans as a culture. I think sometimes we lose sight of that, but veterans, they have their own shared experiences, certainly. They have idioms of distress when it comes to their medical conditions. They have very unique stressors and supports and explanation of illness. In fact, if you look in the DSM that our mental health colleagues use a whole bunch, if you take a look at the way it describes culture, it really applies to veterans. And I think with that in mind, the more exposure that providers have to that veteran experience, even secondhand, the better rapport you can build and the better care that you can provide. So I found that even though I haven't had nearly as intense a military experience as many of the veterans that I treat, that having a little bit of shared common ground breaks down some of these barriers. Most VA docs aren't veterans themselves, and most of them provide absolutely amazing care. I just find that being a veteran myself, I think sometimes I get a little bit of a head start compared to civilian colleagues.
I can imagine those shared experiences allows you to make that instant connection with patients. You know, as someone who is not themselves a veteran, I would love to ask you if you have any recommendations on how can I better understand veteran culture, and are there easy ways to show that you're an ally and that you're open to learning and you really want to connect with these patients?
Oh, God, that's such a great question, Nicole. I teach a class at San Francisco VA for some of the different services on veteran culture. And one of the main ways that I go about teaching it is the recognition that, like any culture, there's a lot of shared experiences, but we need to be cautious about stereotyping. And the challenge with veterans is saying, sailors are this, and soldiers are this, Marines are this, airmen are this. It can obviously be problematic. So I think the best way to approach it in my mind would be the same way you approach any cultural experience, which is one of humility. Veterans assume, and fairly rightly until somewhat recently, that most medical students come from somewhat privileged backgrounds and have probably not served in the military. And with the changing demographics and the work that medical schools have done towards recruiting a more diverse student body, I think that's changing quite a bit. But in general, they're not wrong. Most students don't know a lot about the military. The best thing that you can do is just by practicing culture of humility and being very honest with them, saying, I have no experience in the military. I don't even really know many people in the military. All I really know is what I've seen in TVs and movies, but I want to hear your story. Can you tell me about that? You mentioned you were a LERP in Vietnam. I don't know what a LERP is. Can you tell me what that is? Veterans appreciate it. Veterans, for the most part, appreciate an authentic interest in their experience, like we all do. So I've had students or trainees ask me, is there books that I can read? Really, the best book is the patient themselves, and just asking questions of them and hearing their story. Not only does it, I think, give you a good exposure to the veteran experience, but it's such a great tool for building rapport. And patients who feel that you authentically care about their experience are going to be more approachable, they're going to be more participatory in treatment, and you'll be a better doctor because of it.
Having these open-ended questions, really the storytelling is a way of connection, and it's truly what our podcast is all about, and I love that. Something else that we're really passionate about on this podcast is mental health, And so we were hoping to discuss really what it's like to provide mental health care for veterans. Can you tell us a little bit more about what your day-to-day looks like? What unique considerations do you have to make caring for veterans versus caring for patients who have not been in war?
Sure, sure. So every psychiatrist is different, obviously, so we all have slightly different jobs. My day-to-day routines are, happily for me, pretty varied. I'm currently medical director of a psychiatric urgent care clinic at San Francisco VA, as well as working in psychiatric emergency settings. I like the variety that this offers and not really knowing what a typical day might look like, not really necessarily knowing what's going to be walking in the door. My first love when I came to medicine, I was convinced I was going to be an emergency medicine doctor until I came to a very slow and somewhat painful realization that I wanted to be the sort of person who was an emergency medicine doctor rather than practice emergency medicine. So psychiatry is wonderful in that there's so many diverse experiences that I'm still able to work in these settings, and I enjoy the sort of tempo and the unpredictable nature of it, but still get to practice psychiatry, which is a better fit for me. I'm also a forensic psychiatrist. So in addition to that sort of emergency setting, I also get to take on more detailed and slow-moving cases in which I look through a lot of information and do a lot of research in which I try to form opinions or recommendations for issues related to safety or capacity or things like that as well. So for me, it's a nice mix of treatment that's very fast-paced and intuitive with work that's also very sort of longer-term and deliberate. And I really like that combination.
You know, I have not heard of the field of forensic psychology before. I'd love to hear what brought you to this field. And then if you can describe kind of what's involved in a violence risk assessment and why that assessment is necessary.
So forensic psychiatry, which is different than forensic psychology, both are a subspecialty. One is pursued by psychologists, one by psychiatrists. In my case, after completing residency at UCSF, I did one more year at UCSF for a forensic psychiatry fellowship. Forensic psychiatry is basically where mental health and the law meet. So it's the idea that some fields in medicine, there are these elements in which the medical condition very much affects their involvement in the justice system. So for psychiatry, forensic psychiatry looks into things such as whether or not someone had the mental capacity to commit a crime they're accused of, whether someone has the cognitive ability to change their will, whether or not someone was not guilty by reason of insanity for something they were charged with. So forensic psychiatry really is trying to take your medical knowledge and then learn enough about the legal world so that you can apply it in that domain so that the judges and the juries can make more informed decisions. Forensic psychiatry, you'll take a case in which you are trying to formulate the opinion of what sort of suffering someone is experiencing, and you spend a lot of time really getting to know that person, getting to know that case. And then when it's over, you walk away and start a new one. So it's sort of a lifelong learning process. Violence risk assessment is a specific subset of forensic psychiatry. And at its most simplistic, a violence risk assessment is essentially an evaluation of the presence or absence of risk factors and the presence or absence of protective factors. That's certainly a simplification, but to be honest, that's not far from it in its entirety. Risk factors are things that elevate the risk of potential violence. Protective factors are elements which reduce the risk of potential violence. If it's done well, a violence risk assessment can give a healthcare team an idea of the level of concern that we might have for a patient's potential for violence. And possibly more importantly, we can identify what factors are contributing to that risk. A lot of these risk factors and protective factors are dynamic, or they're modifiable. And that way, if the patient has, say, undermanaged substance use disorder or homelessness, we can try to address these elements to reduce the potential risk of violence. So rather than thinking of it as sort of a thumbs up, thumbs down evaluation or like a danger rating on a scale of 1 to 10, a good violence risk assessment really highlights why an individual may have a higher propensity for violence so that we can try to help that patient. In terms of what brought me into that particular area of interest, I think it's because my main area of clinical and forensic focus has always been about trauma. And trauma, so much of it's about violence. And unfortunately, a lot of that violence is human to human, sometimes accidental, but often deliberate and intentional. And seeing all the pain and suffering and damage that can be caused by trauma, I think I just had a natural curiosity as to why people would do that to one another. And the more you look at violence, the more that you see it. And learning how to assess and prevent violence becomes sort of a wonderful thing. You're not only doing a service to a particular community or an individual, whoever the possible target for the violence might have been, you're also, most importantly, doing a service to your patient. Committing violence can be traumatizing in and of itself. It can be accompanied by reciprocal violence or legal repercussions. And anything we can do to keep our patients out of the legal system as much as possible is a good thing. There's very few conditions that jail and prison is good clinical care for.
Thank you so much for sharing. You know, we're talking about mental health of veterans, and I never like to ignore the practitioner as well. What do you do when you see all of this trauma and you are working a lot with really difficult situations? How do you yourself take care of yourself and your own mental health?
Oh, that's such an excellent question. And particularly because I know your podcast is popular among trainees who are trying to build some of these habits. For me, the one thing I've always given advice to medical students or other trainees as they're starting is always to choose one thing in your life that has nothing to do with medicine, and preferably one thing that has nothing to do with your fellow trainees. Keep something that's important and meaningful to you that you can turn to that has nothing to do with your career. I find for me, working with so much with a traumatized population, you need to be cautious about vicarious trauma, which can be sort of suffering the effects of trauma by hearing so much of it secondhand. It's problematic for the person experiencing it. It also really reduces your effectiveness as a clinician and leads to burnout, which I believe your podcast is addressed directly. The thing that I find most helpful is you want to be as empathetic and present for your patients. It's critical for treating their trauma. When you are done, you need to be able to turn to an aspect of your life that is not erratic or violent or traumatizing, to find your sort of soft spot to land. That can be through hobbies, that can be through faith, that can be through relationships, but having something that then has nothing to do with your work can be particularly helpful, and it can lead to good coping mechanisms rather than mechanisms that can be problematic later, like feeding your stress or turning to drugs or alcohol.
I love your answer to that, because caring for the caregiver is such an important thing to do, right? We cannot just keep depleting ourselves and then just burn out. If we want to continue and sustain as you have, we do need to keep caring for ourselves. I really appreciate your reflecting that back. I think it's great advice. We're talking a little bit about mental health, the mental health of the providers, the physicians, and also the mental health and mental illness of our veterans. And we found an article that was published this year in 2022, and it said that the most publicized mental health challenges that are facing veterans service members are PTSD and depression, and that some research has shown that around 14 to 16% of U.S. service members deployed to Afghanistan and Iraq have PTSD or depression. Dr. Mato, from your experience, how do you feel the landscape of mental health has changed as the nature of combat and war have changed over these years? And can you give us any particularly meaningful patient examples?
The rates you're talking about for PTSD and depression, the challenge comes that a lot of our veterans, when they return from combat, a lot of the signs and symptoms of trauma-related disorders and depression, some of them can be self-limited. Some individuals will come back, they'll have nightmares, they'll have a difficult time adjusting, and then with tincture of time, the symptoms will fade and resolve on their own. That can also be true with the depressive symptoms. The reason the 16% statistic, and I'm not familiar with that particular study, the reason that doesn't totally surprise me is if that was the rate of individuals 3 months outside of their combat deployment, I would worry that's underreported. If it's taken in totality of 2 million service members over a 20-year war, many of those folks will have hopefully received treatment, and if not, at least have had some time and hopefully a supportive environment that may have also been quite therapeutic. There's certainly changes in both the landscape of mental health as provided to veterans, as well as the changing experiences of the veterans themselves. In regard to the changing of the landscape of mental health and how it's provided to veterans, we're blessed in that veterans, more than many other cultural groups, there's a lot of money and resources devoted specifically to their care. And that's a wonderful thing because we have some of the cutting-edge treatments in mental health are actually being done at the VA, some of which you would not necessarily expect. So some of the treatments for MDMA for PTSD is done by, the government with federal health care, which is surprising to a lot of people. Also, other forms of augmented therapy. I worked on a project using virtual reality treatment for prolonged exposure therapy, which is a modality to recreate potentially traumatic experiences from a veteran's past in a way that can be controlled and slowly increased so that they're able to better process that trauma. So there's been a lot of changes in treatment. There's also been a lot of changes in awareness of mental health. Some of that is the product of the VA and other services like that, but also giving credit where credit's due, a lot of that comes from the military itself. The military has recognized that it's become more and more of an issue, particularly because the recent wars, I believe the statistic was in World War II, something like 20 or 22% of eligible individuals fought. In Vietnam, it was 6 or 7%. In Iraq and Afghanistan, it's been 1%, and that's for the country's longest war. So what that means is these individuals have gone and been deployed repeatedly in ways that haven't happened very much in past wars. So because of that, the trauma burden has been fairly extensive for these men and women. And because of that, I think the military has sort of recognized and tried to destigmatize PTSD as much as possible. I remember a time in the Army, there were speeches publicized by General Schwarzkopf from Desert Storm talking about having PTSD, and that would have been unheard of 30 years ago. So I think there's been a lot of progress in that regard as well.
I love hearing all of the progress and all of the resources that are available. I wanted to ask, are there barriers to veterans receiving mental health care?
Yes, unfortunately, there are definitely barriers. And that's one of the things that is sometimes most challenging because a lot of those barriers are outside of our immediate domain of influence as clinicians. In spite of all of the efforts over the past 20 years to destigmatize mental health, it's still a barrier that is a component of the military population and also the civilian population. Different communities and different cultures have different levels of stigmatization and the way they view mental health. And traditionally in the military, it's been quite elevated. There are often fears of being seen as weak, fears of looking or feeling like a failure, the embarrassment of trying to reach out for help. With the military, it's very much of the culture is about being capable and being in control. And reaching out for help with mental health, and particularly with issues of addiction, a lot of that is recognizing that you are not able to deal with it yourself. And that can be a bitter pill for anyone to swallow, but particularly for veterans. Veterans went through a period of time in the military in which they're sort of expected to embody these values and characteristics that are hard or impossible to achieve even in the best of circumstances, but it's even harder to maintain those standards after leaving the military. And particularly when that's coupled with coming to terms with some of these experiences that you may have had while serving, combat, military sexual trauma, other losses. So this failure to live up to the stereotype of the strong, resilient, unbreakable soldier or sailor or airman or Marine, it can be really pronounced, and it can lead to a reluctance to admit to suffering from mental health or substance issues and reluctant to seek out the help that they need.
So glad you brought that up, Dr. McCall, because there's a term that's coming around much more in the world of medicine that is borrowed from the military, and I'm sure that you know that, the term moral injury, and that moral injury that many physicians, COVID and pre-COVID and post-COVID, that many physicians are feeling in their experience of the practice of medicine, feels like their morality is injured, and it feels like they're made to do things that don't feel aligned with their sense of ethics and morality. And that language has never been used before until a few years ago when an article came out and when I learned of it the first time. And now we're using it more and more in describing many physicians' experience, which is different from burnout. It's a different experience than it is just burnout. And I was surprised when I read more about the origin coming from what people in the military feel in the settings that you described.
I think that's an excellent observation. Becoming a physician, there's expectations not unlike the military in that you will perform, you will not get it wrong because that would hurt your patients. And there's a real tax on you for doing that. And because the criteria to even get into medical school is so high, we tend to get a lot of folks that are able to achieve that excellence. When folks are deviate from that for very humanistic reasons, there can be a lot of self-flagellation. There can be a lot of beating yourself up over it. One thing that I noticed during COVID, particularly during the early phases, is it was particularly hard even on the people that I think students and trainees look up to as role models. They could see them reaching their breaking points. So I worked on a program at San Francisco VA of providing trauma-informed and assisted care, particularly to our internist colleagues who were bearing the brunt of some of the risk and definitely the hours during the early days of the pandemic. It's not unlike what you see from folks from war, of being pushed to your breaking point, of risking your life, and seeing a lot of unnecessary death around you. I think those parallels are extremely, extremely similar.
Can you describe some of the consequences of lack of mental health care for veterans? And are there any areas where we can intervene?
Sure. For the consequences for lack of treatment to mental health care is, I think, somewhat analogous to other forms of illness. Sometimes, in my opinion, this isn't shared by everyone's, I think we view psychiatry as something more different than it really is. If we see psychiatry as largely the management of chronic illness, I think we recognize a lot more similarities. And it, because of stigma and I think inappropriate visualizations of what mental illness is, there's a view of, well, it'll just go away. Well, if you are stronger, you could don't have to deal with it. If you go to church more, maybe it will fade. If you live a better life, you won't have these issues. These are things that are still commonly told to people suffering from mental health issues that I don't think we would say to someone who's dealing with, say, congestive heart failure or other chronic illnesses. But in that same vein, if not treated, although some illnesses may spontaneously resolve, many of them will get progressively worse and potentially be crippling and certainly reduce quality of life. With veterans' mental health, we're somewhat blessed with having as close to socialized medicine as we have in this country. And it's a fairly robust system with a lot of services available to our veterans. The main interventions we can do is getting them into care. And then to your point, Nicole, I think one of the things that can be most helpful to keep in mind, both within the VA system and outside of the VA system, is the recognition of the power that social services plays. Sometimes as physicians, we are not always good about seeing outside our particular guild. For issues of mental health and issues of all health, really, recognition of all of the social determinants play is just absolutely critical.
As we wrap up this podcast today, do you have any advice for trainees as we work alongside and care for veterans?
It goes back to what I mentioned before about recognizing them as this culture. One teaching point I use with students and trainees is, in general, I find that most folks who pursue medical or healthcare careers tend to enjoy travel. I think it's just a feature of having an open mind, and open minds lending themselves well to healthcare. One advice I give trainees is, as you go through the many rotations that you do in your training to become a nurse or a doctor or a social worker, if you view each rotation as if you were traveling, and you keep that sort of traveler's mindset, and you just recognize that it's a new place, and you think, what would it be like to stay here, and have an open mind with all of the different experiences and the lingo and the different people, I find that these are folks who tend to be most happy in their training. And also, I would argue, those who become the best clinicians. I would really emphasize that with the rotations that trainees do with veterans. If you recognize that this is a population of people that culturally are probably as foreign to you as many different countries you can travel to, recognize that they likely have different politics. They may have different views on the use of force or violence. They may have different views on things like integrity and service. If you recognize that, and then go in with an open mind and ask those open-ended questions that you talked about and hear their stories, if you do that, you will build a rapport from a population that can sometimes be not trusting of the medical community, and oftentimes with good reason. I can point out on a map in my office pockets of California where we still have veterans that never quite integrated into civilian culture after the war in Vietnam. I can't emphasize enough that after 20 years of fighting the global war on terror with a population of veterans with multiple deployments, with excessive trauma exposure, the time you spend just sort of bearing witness to what they've been through and embodying compassionate care, you really make all the difference in the world.
Thank you so much for joining us today. It was such a thoughtful and really enlightening conversation.
Thank you, Dr. Matto.
Thank you both for your time. I appreciate the opportunity to be here.
Thank you for tuning in today
and allowing us to be one of your meaningful moments.
Please rate, review, and subscribe, and share with friends, family, and colleagues. Meaningful Medicine was produced by Shiva Kayambashi, Nicole Hohenstein, David Elkin, Nikki Elkin, Ahaley Chattopadhyay, and Leigh Kodama. Editing by Nicole Hohenstein, Nikki Elkin, and Leigh Kodama. Intro and closing by Daniel Wendling. On Meaningful Medicine, we are careful to ensure that all stories are compliant with healthcare privacy laws, and details may have been changed to ensure patient confidentiality. All views expressed are of the person speaking and not their employer.